Hello, and welcome to SearchContentManagement.com. I'm Lauren Horwitz, Executive Editor in the Business Applications and Architecture Group. And given the number of corporate-related data breaches we encounter almost every day, we wanted to revisit the subject of information management and content security today. Technology trends such as cloud computing and mobile devices have changed the nature of security, forcing companies to look not only at protecting the network and devices, but also the content itself. So today, to discuss some of the issues surrounding content-based security and information management, I have the great pleasure to welcome back Sean Schell and introduce Jonathan Bordoli, both of Hitachi Consulting. Jonathan, Sean, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Lauren.
Good morning.
It's terrific. We haven't done a kind of a three-way conversation, so I'm looking forward to this. And I have a bunch of questions for you. So let's start out with maybe giving readers a sense of how things have changed a little bit. And Sean, I'm going to start with you. How should companies think about protecting content these days?
I think you mentioned cloud at the outset, and from my perspective, there is absolutely kind of a new world emerging. And while cloud is not necessarily new, what is more true today is that large companies, especially ones in regulated industries, are beginning to adopt, in effect, data centers and storage mechanisms that they don't directly own and control. And what we're also seeing at the regulatory level is governments around the world struggling a little bit, trying to figure out things like jurisdiction. And you, we're probably going to talk about data sovereignty. That's a deep issue. Organizations who have their own internal auditing requirements and how those change when they don't own the equipment or the data centers where that content is stored. And the fact, largely, that PCs are no longer the ruling device in this ecosystem, that we have devices that are very mobile, meaning they're being carried on a person from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, or that the device isn't even owned, like the data centers, that this mobile device isn't owned by the organization either. It may be the employees or that individual's personal device, and how does the company control access to content? I think it's a fascinating, interesting sort of situation we find ourselves in, and I can imagine for certain groups within these organizations, kind of scary as well.
Absolutely. Big, you know, high-stakes results. So, Jonathan, now I want to ask you, maybe you could map out for our readers, you know, there are a variety of ways to think about protecting content these days, and I talked a little bit about this in the intro. You know, there was protecting the network, there's things like protecting devices, mobile device management, things of that nature. And then there's also content-based security and controls. Could you map out some of those different ways of thinking about securing data for readers?
Yeah, absolutely. I think first and foremost, it's about somebody's identity. So if we think about me being an employee in a company, I potentially have lots of identities. I may have an identity as known in an HR solution, and may have an identity as known in some content management and collaboration solution. And clearly outside of the company, I've got many identities, Facebook, Google, and whatever. So I think one of the big things that we need to think about is what is Jonathan's identity, and where is he known, and how do we know him? And the next thing I need to think about is, given the myriad of identities he has and the number of solutions he can visit, how do I map those identities to the content sources? And again, content sources could be Salesforce, Oracle, a myriad of solutions. So we need to think about kind of rules-based solutions that allow a mapping of an identity, which I can pick up through an authentication mechanism such as a token or a login or any number of techniques, and I need to have security in that realm to know that the person giving the identity is really that person, through to the information, and is that itself secure, and is it encrypted, and I may be accessing that in the country or out of the country or traveling, and then through to actually applying some security rights to content as it's stored in those systems. And of course, that could be a document that I'm storing, or it could actually be a piece of data within a record. So if I've got a people record, a bit of data might be a social security number. I may want to protect that as opposed to an address. So I need to think about information holistically in all of these different ways.
A lot of different aspects to kind of take on. Okay, so now my second question, and Sean, again, I'm going to start with you. How does compliance add a whole other layer onto this conversation?
You know, it's an interesting question. Again, given our current state and where we are in history, you know, compliance is a very broad topic, from regulatory compliance to internal audit or internal policy issues that companies have to accommodate, again, either because they're adhering to some law or they have an internal policy they need to match up. And as Jonathan mentioned, the variety of content spans the gamut of things that are fairly low security, an address of a company, for example, to something that's quite sensitive and deals in a regulatory issue perhaps around privacy that may be further compounded by n number of jurisdictions where that content might be stored who have differing opinions about how that particular piece of content needs to be addressed in terms of access. And so what we're seeing now is that organizations are having to create a fairly complicated matrix of compliance governing policies, essentially, that technology has to help these organizations address. And I'm not sure that there's a singular answer, unfortunately, at the moment, and organizations are having to deal with a constant set of changing standards. Safe Harbor, which has been the foundation upon which many U.S.-based organizations dealt with privacy in the EU, was struck down, and it's now each individual EU member's responsibility to address how privacy and data is handled within their jurisdiction, which now super complicates, say, U.S. entities' approach to securing that data.
So now I'm going to throw another factor onto this, and Jonathan, I'm going to throw this to you, and it's kind of twofold. You know, to some extent, one of the traditional objections to the cloud has been, you know, compliance, either, you know, internal policies, as Sean mentioned, or actually industry regulations that prohibit certain data from being accessible. So how does cloud computing affect this equation? And for regulated industries that need to comply with, say, industry regulations, is a hybrid cloud approach where you have some things in the cloud, some things behind the firewall, does that make more sense for some companies?
Not necessarily more sense. I mean, an opportunity that the cloud gives to us, particularly in global terms, is to start to nominate or specify where data should be stored. So Sean mentioned the EU regulations. And they're pretty complex, but essentially it's about a set of controls or minimum standards around which you would protect certain data. So cloud gives us the ability to build a worldwide solution and yet nominate bits of the data that we want to be stored within particular regions of countries. So that's one way we can help manage the situation. And another way is back to some of the fine-grained concepts that I talked about initially. So if we think of some particular regulation like ITAR, which is to do with regulations of arms control for defense industry, it's not that all data can't be shared, and it's more about the person and what a particular person is allowed to see and where they are. So again, I think cloud gives us an opportunity to regionalize data and move it out to different places and helps abide by some of these regulations that we see being driven at a country level.
You know, it's interesting about that, Lauren. So Jonathan talked about cloud as almost as if it gave companies a lot of additional flexibility and made the world, at least in some respects, slightly more simple. I had kind of come at it, based on my previous responses, as it complicated matters. I think it's fascinating that two divergent opinions, people who are literally at the moment sitting 3 feet apart, can be the same response or perhaps the right response to the question itself. And I can totally see Jonathan's point of view. You know, in some ways, I talked about all of the moving parts, all of the complexity that's gotten created when you begin to introduce all the dimensions of security. And Jonathan's point of view said, well, that's right, but I now have a great deal more flexibility in controlling aspects of that by not being worried so much about where data sits, because I can nominate what data sits in a particular data center. Microsoft, for example, has this concept of regions, which is 2 to 14 data centers spread across the globe. And when I provision a particular set of services inside of Azure, I can nominate which data center those services will exist in. And if I'm dealing with issues of compliance or security, or I need to adhere to a particular set of regulations within a jurisdiction, I can simply identify the data center or region for the data that I have concerns about in the area where I now can establish sort of a concrete set of standards, and I don't have to worry about the varying standards that may exist across the world. I think that's a super compelling argument for cloud in general, not necessarily hybrid, but hybrid may do the same thing, right? Those things that I can control or can't control well in the cloud, I simply say I'm going to own that myself, and I'll build my data centers around just that, those bits of content.
And maybe can I just add to that as well, because the EU or the Safe Harbor Agreement that was taken down last year, Sean mentioned earlier, interestingly, and I believe I got my facts right, Microsoft has various clauses and working party agreements with the EU, which allows EU citizen data to be stored within a Microsoft-controlled data center. So not necessarily just Microsoft. I think other data center providers will also be getting these clauses underwritten. But it can still be complex for an enterprise that won't naturally have those clauses in place. So if you're a global company with employees in Europe and the U.S., you need to think very carefully about where you're going to be storing that employee data.
So you guys have set the stage very nicely for the next thing that I wanted to talk about, which is data sovereignty, which is this idea that data is subject to the laws in the country in which that data actually physically resides. So I guess I want to ask, now with cloud computing and data sovereignty on the table, does cloud computing make data sovereignty easier or more difficult? And I'm not even sure who I want to ask about this first, but maybe I'll start with you, Sean.
All right. I don't actually know whether it makes it more difficult or easier. I have seen cases on both sides. The Microsoft has been the one kind of at the forefront with the number of cases, even arguing at the Supreme Court level around issues of retrieving data for Microsoft, who is a U.S.-based company, that happened to have stored data in question in Ireland. And the issue was, does the United States government have the right to ask Microsoft to produce content that does not exist inside the U.S. for a customer that may also not exist in the U.S.? And, you know, in that way, cloud probably makes things more complicated, in part because there isn't a physicality to content as there are with objects like a chair or a table, right? If the chair or table exists in the EU, the U.S. government really can't ask Microsoft or a party to go grab the chair and table and bring it across the ocean. However, it's super easy, in fact, to grab content from a data center anywhere in the world and pull it into what virtually is the United States, into the United States borders. And I think that plays into this idea that somehow governments around the world think because it's so easy to pull this data across geopolitical borders, that as long as the organization that they have subpoenaed owns the data centers, regardless of their location, that they should have control and jurisdiction over the data itself. And I think that those discussions are ongoing, and that is kind of the heart of data sovereignty. I think the interconnected nature of these computer systems has caused us to reconsider our physical geopolitical boundaries relative to those that might exist in the sort of virtual world of cyberspace.
Right. Jonathan, I guess I want to ask the same question of you. How do you think the interplay between cloud computing and data sovereignty is kind of playing out?
As far as a lawyer, I think I'd want to say it depends. Sean's made some great points, and I think it's about design. I think probably what's happening now is that we've built this world on the cloud with different data centers, and we now are having various rule changes, and everybody is still trying to figure out what the impact of that's going to be and how, in fact, they'll manage it. So there's many implications from the social world and the world which we live in outside of work, such as Facebook, and where can Facebook keep its data, through to commercial worlds, such as hospitals, and can a German hospital now process patient data in the U.S.? So lots of questions, maybe not too many answers right now, but I think the key thing is to go into any initiative with an open mind, with the regulation at hand, and to design as best as you can for what we know today and the future.
Mm. And to Jonathan's point about the German hospital, in the U.S., healthcare organizations make their partners, meaning a Microsoft or an Amazon that might own cloud services that hospital is using, they make them sign a business associates agreement. And essentially it transfers some amount of the regulatory constraints that hospital happens to be under to their partners, and so their partners are not having to adhere to those very same rules. And it's a mechanism to try to control some of the challenges that we're seeing, not only around data sovereignty, but the various privacy laws, and create a situation where we can, in fact, continue to move business forward without being paralyzed by the number of moving parts involved.
And so now, finally, I want to ask of both of you, without asking you to predict the future, what might be some of the trends that we're going to see in the area of data and content security over the next, say, 12 to 18 months? Jonathan, let's start with you.
I see two, actually. I think I've mentioned the word identity and access management a couple of times. I think there's a lot of effort now from the industry to work really hard on this aspect of identity and access management. And I think what the cloud is giving us an opportunity to do is to build identity and access management solutions in the cloud, which then provision all of my solutions, whether they be it in the cloud or on-premise, with those identities. I think another key trend in the industry then is to support that with what we call fine-grained authorization, where we're able to look at any piece of content, wherever it is in any solution, and apply some attributes to that, and then marry up that content to the identities, all driven by a set of business rules.
And Sean?
Well, last year we did a couple of things in terms of writing pieces on content security. And playing off of what Jonathan said, I think identity management and access controls are absolutely key. And as I pointed out previously, those don't go quite far enough simply because those tend to be focused, at least the access controls, on the repository where the data is stored. And Microsoft and others, SAP, Oracle, they're all working on what amounts to rights management. So we're starting to bundle the permissions that any given identity happens to have to a specific piece of content with the content itself. So we're encapsulating or putting an envelope around content such that it's not so much about the repository where that thing exists, but rather the permissions that identities have been granted on the object, and the object carries those permissions with it, which makes the identity control access management at least a good bit more important to have this unified sense of an identity. We're also seeing a great deal more emphasis being put on encryption. Over the last 2 years, there's been a number of sort of major defects on the sort of encryption technologies that have been kind of pervasively used throughout all of these web technologies in particular, and a recognition that we need to combine identity and access controls with permissions at the content level with an at-rest encryption approach, so that even if the underlying data center or an individual machine is compromised, that the people who are compromising these systems won't end up with anything that's actually useful. And that goes for both structured and unstructured data.
Well, Sean, Jonathan, we've covered a lot of ground here, and I so appreciate your joining us today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you, Lauren.
And I hope we'll get a chance to do this again soon. And always, for more on information management and content management, you can check out searchcontentmanagement.com. And until next time, I'm Lauren Horwitz.